This is an ABC podcast.
This is The Conversation Hour
on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
What changes have you seen in sport in your lifetime? What attitudes do you think are still too old-fashioned and need to change? A little bit of out with the old and in with the new.
Skinfold tests, coaches who yell and talk down to you in front of teammates, or the idea that you have to be a certain body type to play a certain sport. Think netballers that need to be tall, dancers that can't have big breasts, or maybe you need to have a six-pack and exactly 0% body fat to play Aussie rules.
Well, Kieran Perkins, the Swimming Australia president, has called for, in the world of swimming anyhow, to abandon what he calls damaging, debunked obsession with body weight and shape. And he says that coaches that can't adapt should actually look for another career. He goes as far as saying he wants to see changes to skinfold tests, a ban on the word physique, and a quota for women coaches in a sport like swimming, where there are lots and of young girls and women.
Perkins also noted how little things had changed since his heyday late last century in the swimming world. So what has changed and what hasn't changed in the sport that you love or play or support from a grassroots level towards the very top?
So maybe you've walked away from a sport because you think the attitude was all wrong or a little outdated. Were there elements that made you feel uncomfortable? Or for a glass half full, have you found a coach or a sport that supports and embraces a more modern way of thinking? What's changed and what still needs to change in the sport that you love?
This is The Conversation Hour
on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
Good morning, I'm Rochelle Hunt and I'm in Melbourne.
And I'm Erin Delahunty. I'm coming to you from a very humid Bendigo in central Victoria.
Today we're looking at what needs to change in sport, you know, attitudes primarily that keep people in sport and sort of an old-fashioned way. And it was funny, Erin, I was thinking about this last night, knowing coming into today's show, and I loved playing sport as a kid. I was super C grade. You know, I wasn't very good at sport. I'm an average C in everything when I was growing up, but I still loved to participate. What I hated, though, was PE. And so I started to think last night, why did I hate PE but then loved sport? And it actually just came down to the PE teacher versus my coach. PE in the 80s was humiliating. I felt like its purpose was to embarrass you and humiliate you. We had, I'll never forget this, one time in our big old stinky hot hall, where, by the way, there was no separate, there was a boys' change room and a girls' change room, but it was all in one. So you were mortified getting changed in front of other girls. But we had skinfold tests in front of everyone.
Wow.
At school, when you're going through puberty, like, I'm scarred from that, I think.
Look, I certainly never had to endure the skinfold tests. It's kind of shocking to think that that was the norm for a lot of schools or team sports or whatever it might have been. Like I said, I don't want to think about how that would have dealt with a very fragile Erin Delahunty at that age. As you say, getting dressed in front of your peers, that can be challenging enough. And we know so well now that the direct correlation, I guess, that we have between these experiences as young people and the way that we feel about our bodies later on in life. So this is why it's such a fascinating subject to talk about today, because I think it's difficult to disconnect those two issues, because sport is inherently a physical thing. It's something that we do with our bodies. But there certainly have been a lot of changes over the years, and I would really like to think that no year 8 or year 9 girl is going to PE today and having skinfold tests done, that's for sure.
What's changed? And it might be in the world of PE. If you're a PE teacher, then I would love to hear from you today as well. Or if you're a local coach, you know, netball coach or footy coach or whatever it may be. Because that's the other thing that we can get into later on, you know, with PE at school. Erin, there was always two captains that were picked that were the fittest or the coolest. And then they would just pit everyone off. So it was just us, you know, weirdos that couldn't play. I was always the last or the second last to get picked. And you knew when they were going in, okay, let's pick teams. You'd just be like, oh, here we go again. Like, why put us through this? I mean, I wonder whether even that process of how you pick teams has changed within PE, because it's not fun.
No, it's not fun. But I do think that it can very much depend on your particular coach or your particular PE teacher, because I know growing up, certainly for me, netball was always my sport of choice, and I always had really welcoming, really encouraging coaches. So I have really fantastic memories of them, you know, letting me, teaching me and helping me understand the benefit of my body, where it was, because as you say, in puberty, particularly for young girls, there can be some real awkwardness as we sort of grow into ourselves. I'm a lovely stature, 6 foot now. Rish, it's taken me a decade or so to even be able to proudly say that. But growing up, I was just average. I was the normal height of everybody, and I was sort of a nuggety goal defender that used to be out the front, in the front of someone really tall behind me. And then I suddenly grew, you know, many, many inches sort of in one school holidays, and I came back for year 12, and all of a sudden I was this 6 foot tall kid, and I was all arms and legs and a bit gangly. But then the same netball coach that sort of identified that, you know, I was fantastic and how to use my ability at goal defence said, okay, well, now you're a different body type. You're going to be a goalkeeper now. You're going to be our rebound machine. And I sort of went, okay, cool. And here I am 42 years later, you know, however many years later.
Still a rebound machine.
KPIs for a 6 foot tall goalkeeper is taking rebounds. So I think it can very much depend on the individual experience that you have.
Oh, let's get into that a little later, because I've even heard stories of tall people being stopped in the street saying, oh, I coach basketball, you should be on my side. So that assumption too, that if you're tall, you must love basketball. Dr. Stephen Wren is Associate Professor in Sports and Coaching at the University of Queensland. Stephen, I guess let's start at the beginning. What makes a good coach?
As you've noted in the introductions and your discussions just there, it can vary from place to place and time to time. So the kinds of coaches that we want when we're first engaging in sport is going to be very different to those stages where we're developing our craft and becoming maybe more serious about sport. And it's going to be different to the kind of coach that we want at the elite level. And I think what happens, and some of the worst things I've seen in sport, is where those at junior levels and in schools and phys ed teachers are applying models of performance that are not appropriate at that level. Mm. So for me, what makes a good coach, a fundamental that runs through all forms of coaching, is care, because coaches are responsible for those in their charge. And a lot of time we're working with really young people. So care has to be the fundamental starting point.
So, Dr. Wren, is the example that Rish used there of having skinfold tests done in high school an example of what you were talking about there, about taking an elite approach at a very grassroots level?
Oh, absolutely, because Kieran Perkins in a recent article talked about the need for dialogue about what's relevant. And for me, skinfolds at a school level is completely irrelevant. So it's people thinking they're being sciencey and cutting edge in a place that it just is not warranted, and there's absolutely no need for it. So the damaging things that can come out of that can be long-lasting and are not really trying to achieve any of the things that the coach, or in this case the phys ed teacher, is trying to achieve.
Do you think that there still is a place for something like that at the very elite level? I know that last year, I think the AFL decided coming into the draft combine that they weren't even going to use those skin fold tests. Is there still a place for them, Dr. Wren?
Oh, it's really specific for the particular sport and the moment in the career and all of those kinds of things. Because when you're talking about skin fold is a measure or an approximate measure of body composition. So it's not the gold standard anymore, but it is an approximate measure of what composition your body has. Now, whether or not that's relevant to the performance, that's up to individual sports and coaches and the individual person, because as we've seen in recent times, there have been people who have challenged the body norms in a lot of different sports. And I think the idea that you have to have this perfect mesomorphic tiny skin fold body to be successful in sport has really been challenged on a number of fronts.
And I think Swimming Australia, not that today's conversation is broader than swimming, but I don't think they're going to abandon them. I think they're going to just maybe do them somewhere a little more private as well. So not necessarily while you're in the togs on the side of the pool. But there's a, another woman here, Susan in Hawthorne, sent a text saying, well, what is a skin fold test? But I guess you've just sort of explained that, Stephen, in going in to be able to gauge the amount of fat or body fat on a body. But I was watching some really old football footage the other day. Call me a little sad, but I was, and this is men's football. When you look at the footy players, right, of the 70s and the 80s and their physique versus the football players, both men and women now, they are vastly different. But I don't know whether or not they're any better, but you would see footy players, with one of a better term, a gut. Like they just had normal physiques. They had, I'm not saying it's a beer gut, but they had a gut.
Yeah, and I guess that's a good point. The skin fold, if you don't understand what it is, it can be, you think maybe it's a really scientific and important part of elite sport, but really it's a pretty crude measure where a qualified person, ideally, but in the case of phys ed, it's just the phys ed teacher, will pinch your skin and measure with a set of calipers the size of that pinch. And they do that on a number of different sites across the body.
Yes.
Yeah. And so it can be used in a really pretty dehumanising way. And we do see that. It can be really embarrassing. I know as a former cyclist, not a very good one, I've been involved in skin folds. And even when I was really fit, I found it really embarrassing and I didn't want to do it in front of my teammates. And it's often used as a really punitive thing. We're going to do skin folds at the start of the season so we can develop some kind of fat club and be punitive in what we do. It's not about what do we need to do to perform well. It's actually used as a bit of a punishment in a lot of cases.
Is it especially an issue when we're talking about women and females in sport, do you think, Dr. Rin?
I think it's at its most problematic and most visible when that's the case. Because a lot of the cases that we're hearing about are young women, and we know also that young men are under increasing pressure about their bodies as well. But this has been an issue for young women for the longest time, and so I think what has gone largely unspoken in this is that it's mostly male coaches, mostly male strength and conditioning coaches, mostly male exercise physiologists who are doing this as well. So I think there's extra problems that come with that as well.
And that's one of the changes that Swimming Australia is calling for, is a higher quota of female coaches. This is something that I didn't expect to come up. I wonder how much of our fear around humiliation in sport or not wanting to get involved in sport comes from PE and PE at school. There's another text here saying, oh my God, Rish, I'm exactly the same. I never wanted to do PE at school. I would deliberately forget my uniform so that I didn't have to play. And there's lots of people saying, oh yes, that was me. Just PE at school, how much of an influence does that have on whether or not we just go on to play sport recreationally, you know, for fun as teenagers and as adults?
Yeah, often that's the first place in which we get to experience our bodies in a public fashion, in a performative way. And thankfully, the ways that phys ed has been taught and what phys ed classes look like now have progressed quite a long way from what they used to be. And I know universities like ours and others who are responsible for the training of the next generations of physical education teachers have been really strong in trying to not only connect and engage with the sporty kids, the ones who have grown up in households that embrace sport and have always had bats and balls and rackets and mats and all kinds of things around the home for them to play and experiment with, but also to connect with those who maybe are not inclined to connect in those ways, so they can become physically literate for the rest of their lives, so that they can engage in sport, be as a spectator or as an active participant, well into their adult life and ideally throughout their lifespan. And phys ed is changing in those ways. And phys ed, the training of phys ed teachers is taking into far greater consideration all of these sociological dimensions, not just, you know, the biophysical stuff, not just the body, but also body in space and in relation to others.
And you just touched on it there. How important is the role of parents in this? Because we're obviously talking about our own experiences, but that all interrelates to, as you say, whether you grow up in a sporty household, whether you had a couple of siblings like many of our listeners would have, whether or have children like myself, two young boys that are constantly having a competition. How important is the role of the family and the parents in that, particularly in that when we're talking about PE, I guess, in that primary and early high school cohort?
Oh, absolutely. They're crucial. So you mentioned their parents and siblings really help shape us as people. And that shapes our attitudes towards a whole variety of things, including schooling. So our experiences at home and our early experiences, they really shape how we're likely to engage with different subjects, with different courses, with different teachers. When it comes to sport, parents are additionally important because they are usually the gatekeeper of whether we sign up for it or not. So our parents are the ones who make decisions about, oh, I'm not sure I like that contact sport, or, geez, I've heard there's not great things going on in that particular sport, or, geez, this is a wonderful thing that I'd like my child or children to be involved in. So there's that additional layer of importance that comes with parents.
Or the parents thinking, how early do I need to get up on a Saturday morning?
Rich, you took the words out of my mouth. I was just thinking about little athletics.
You know, not many people want to admit it, but that's what you're thinking. You're thinking, do I really want to travel across town and have to be on site by 8:30 in the morning? Dr. Stephen Rinn is with you, Associate Professor in Sports Coaching at the University of Queensland. Arundella Hunty, Rochelle Hunt, you're on The Conversation Hour. We're talking about what attitudes, you know, what old-fashioned mentalities need to change in sport. And what's come through this is that a lot of it needs to change from PE. I love this text. PE was 45 minutes of Lord of the Flies in the middle of your school day. And I love this one as well that says, mid-1970s North Melbourne player Mick Nolan had a, in inverted commas, gut, a long torso and short legs. Allegedly, he was known to have a dim sim and a stubby at halftime. That's from James. I don't know if that's true or not, but I so want to believe that. Stephen, when we look at changes that need to be made with how we actually coach, so what works, that sort of real crack the whip style and push them as far as you can and treat them mean, keep them keen, I'm going to throw all those sort of sayings in there. Does that still cut through anymore?
Not as much as it used to. So what is coached and how it's coached has changed over time. So in much the same way that teaching and parenting have changed over the years, at the elite level, we see far more collaborative and far less authoritarian styles and approaches to coaching. And part of this is in response to better understandings of motivation, so trying to foster more internal forms of motivation. I do this because I want to or because I know it's good for me, rather than I'm doing it because I don't want to get yelled at. And part of it is also about better understandings of learning. We're trying to get more embodied understandings of learning. And modern coaches are less concerned about, can my athlete tell me all of the ins and outs of the technical details of the sport, or can they actually do it, and can they do it under pressure? So there seems to be a much greater focus on that rather than the rant and rave. It comes from better understandings of how people work and how we can get not only high performance, but actually deliver on the promise of sport. The whole value proposition of sport is we're going to make better people. It helps us to work in teams. It helps us to persevere, all those kinds of things. But a lot of the traditional old school thinking has not helped to foster those other things. We've got great performances, but we've got a lot of broken people out of it. So modern approaches have tried to address that to a great degree.
Look, I hate to editorialise, but you have to look at someone like Ash Barty as probably an example of what you're talking about there, Dr. Rinn. She talks so much about being a good person as well as a good athlete. I mean, Dylan Alcott is another example of that, that before his Australian Open quad wheelchair final yesterday said, you know, at the end of this, if I win, I win, but if I don't, it's, you know, it's not my entire life's work.
Yeah, it
does really sound as if we have seen a lot of strides made in this space. Thank you so much for speaking to us. That was Dr. Stephen Rinn, Associate Professor in Sports Coaching at the University of Queensland.
There's a text here that says, in inverted commas, my chubby daughter was humiliated by a PE teacher only a few years ago having to do a skin fold test. She was marked and she was given a D. The teacher then shamed me as a parent as well. I was mortified by that. I mean, I'm pretty shocked to think that those skin fold tests still happen. And then there's even text saying that I was shocked to know that I had to do a skin fold test as a part of a fitness test to undergo a undergraduate paramedic degree only 4 years ago. I don't believe this has anything to do with being able to have the ability to do the job of a paramedic. It made me feel really insecure.
That's really surprising to hear that. That's in recent history in the last 4 years. I mean, I imagine there is obviously a physical component to being an ambulance officer, working with another officer. But, yeah, very surprised that that's still the case. And I guess exactly as Dr. Rinn was talking about there, it's about the full context. And does the person understand why that is being done and where does it fit into what they need to do in their role?
If you're a PE teacher, you know, we need to hear whether or not this is changing. And you've got to stand up for yourself a little bit here too, because we don't want this to become a pile-on. And a lot of this is reflection back from the 80s, but we're hearing bits and pieces that it's still happening now. Dr. Zali Yaga is Executive Director of Body Confident Collective. And you've worked in this space, the sporting arena, and how we feel about body types. Zali, people used to be really, really shocked, you know, when I was 14 or so, being 5'1" and playing goal defence. They were like, what's this shorty? I think I was called short ass. That was what they'd say. Yeah, what's she doing playing goal defence? Do we need to rethink what size, height, shape we are and what that means about what sport we can or can't play?
Oh, yes, definitely. And just hearing so many of those comments about health and PE, there is a lot of change that needs to happen in that space. But then also just generally the assumption that the way that you look determines how good you would be in certain sports definitely needs a rethink.
And when does that start to need to change? Does that have to be from a really young age, Dr. Yaga?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, when we sort of make comments about kids' bodies and start to talk about what that might mean about their achievement or their performance, then they start to sort of make assumptions about what they're capable of as well. And that, you know, it might not be something that they're interested in to go and play basketball if they're a very, you know, you have to sort of consider their personality as well.
And what do we know about the mental and psychological impacts of those sort of assumptions that people make?
We don't know some assumptions, but we know a lot about shame. And it's very clear now, we have so much research that shows that shame doesn't motivate health behavior, and it doesn't motivate performance either. And so, you know, in general, talking to kids about, you know, the fact that they are not the size that they should be is something that is not going to make them lose weight. And if that's tension, it's actually going to have the opposite effect, because we now know that that leads to weight gain over time instead of weight loss. So there's just no benefit to shaming kids about the way that they look.
So how do we talk to young kids that look up, you know, we look to the elite level where we do see the absolute peak of performance. How do we talk to our young people about that when we understand they are striving and they are working however many hours in the gym? How do we translate that for them without creating that negative impact?
I think that we need to definitely talk about, because there's what we see in terms of athlete performances and bodies, and we kind of make the assumption that they look like that all of the time. And I think that a lot of junior athletes believe that as well. They think that, you know, the elite level, they have that sort of level of body fat percentage or whatever year round. And it's actually, you know, their sort of training weight is quite different to their performance weight. And I think we need to have conversations about how hard athletes work to look like that and how long it takes, and that it's their job to look like that as well.
There's a text here saying, I attended tech school in 1963. PE was hell. I'd just graduated from primary school and we were all thrown into the community showers. No doors, no partitions. Lots of texts in relation to PE and how it just actually puts people off. But when we're speaking about body types and body shapes, what about ages when it comes to an expectation that you have to stop playing at a certain age? I mean, how relevant is that, do you think?
Yeah, we are seeing a lot of sort of age talk, we call it, where people sort of make negative comments about their appearance based on their age or their capabilities. I mean, personally, my body's very broken from having children and it won't do so
yes,
many of the
things. There's no skipping anywhere in this household. Okay.
And, you know, many joints no longer function as they should. But I think that if people are fully functional, then they should be able to do whatever they like.
And what do you think are some of the positive things that we're seeing? Are there any positive role models that you point to in your work or that you focus on in your work that are doing the right thing in this space?
Well, I think that this Swimming Australia example is a really nice opportunity because what we're seeing is sort of just a conversation opening up, and even this conversation right now, you know, people starting to question that connection between, you know, even health and weight or health and appearance, and starting to think about what is acceptable when we're talking about bodies and what should be acceptable in that athletic environment.
How far is too far though? Like, I know we need to make a lot of changes, but when do we ever push it to where we become a little bit too PC? Is taking the word physique, for example, out of the language in some sports like swimming, is that a step too far?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it's going to be a little bit hard to police the banning of a word, but I think that it does open up a really important conversation around language. And that's one of the things that we're most commonly asked as body image experts is, you know, how do we talk about bodies if we're not allowed to sort of say certain words? And I think it just opens it up to start talking about, well, how do these words make us feel? And how does that judgment sort of creep in inadvertently with the use of some words when we could actually just focus on performance, which is kind of why they're there.
Awesome. Look, thank you so much for your insights today. That's Dr. Zali Yeager, Executive Director of the Body Confidence Collective. Thank you so much.
No worries. Thank you.
This text, Erin, saying, I was once told by a PE teacher that I got fatter every time she saw me. Shameful. Oh. That's from Margaret. I mean, these are just, I mean, they're obvious things that need to change. But even as we were talking earlier in terms of the selection of how you go about picking teams, what sports you played, where you can have the choice of getting changed as well, I think that comes into it. The sort of terminology that we use. But I think Zali raised an interesting point in how do we police that? And I mean, I guess that just comes down to where, thank goodness, now we're living in a culture where we are calling it out more, and maybe it does mean that you yourself need to step up and call it out and you know, say, look, that makes me feel uncomfortable, or you shouldn't use that terminology, or can we maybe have a chat about what just happened there?
I think it's interesting too, because when you play a sport at the grassroots level, I think it's quite natural to look towards the elite and what they're doing and what their performance look like and what their body looks like and things like that. And I know, again, myself being involved in netball, Netball Australia, which is obviously the governing body for the sport, is quite unique in that it only, we talked about skin folds earlier, it only tests skin folds on its senior national team on sort of an opt-in basis, and then you certainly have to be over 18 to do that. And then they're not, the results are confidential and not really used as a metric, but from what I understand, it's rather a tool for them to understand how they can assess their progress. So I think that's different to what maybe some understanding of it is being quite punitive and that sort of thing.
Yeah, but simply like, do you need to lose weight as opposed to...
That's exactly right.
I wanted to, and this is something that I actually kind of wish I had have asked Stephen now, but we can ask some of our next guests, is looking at, well, what makes a good coach, and do coaches get training? I mean, it's just because maybe you're a good player, does that then, and then you decide to not play or you become a player coach, does that make you a good player? And are you following on in coaching techniques of what you were just raised in and with, and were they a little bit out of date and a little bit old fashioned? So are we putting too much pressure onto coaches where maybe they don't need the skills because they're not being taught those things as well?
This is The Conversation Hour.
on ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria.
You're with Rochelle Hunt. I'm in Melbourne. Erin Dallahunty is with you as well. She's broadcasting from our Bendigo studios, and we're talking about what needs to change, what outdated ideas and ideals need to change when it comes to sport, both at a grassroots level and at an elite level, whether it be coaching techniques or our so-called ideals of body types. Lauren has sent this text, Erin, saying, my hubby plays in veterans cricket team, all over 60, many over 70, lots of round body shapes, can't run, can't bend, but they love it. And that's what it's all about, really, isn't it?
Absolutely. There's nothing greater than seeing those masters, whether it's in football. I know it exists in soccer. Certainly in netball, we have what's called walking netball. I'm not sure if you've seen this, Rish.
But I love it already.
It's all kind of wonderful. It doesn't have to be for a particular age group, but it does tend to skew towards someone who's slightly older. And it is exactly the same as netball, but walking. And it's a sight to behold, I have to say.
Well, Lauren's actually given us a call. She's in Mount Evelyn. Lauren, I absolutely loved that message. You know, you can't run, can't bend, but we love it. That should be a motto or a bumper bar sticker. It's really not important, is it? It's about the enjoyment.
No, look, I think it started, I don't know when it started, but my husband started playing when he was over 40, and then it sort of morphed into over 50 and then over 60, and now he's 75. And they just all love it. And some of them, one of them I think can bend down and be the wicket keeper, so he's always the wicket keeper. And some of them stop the ball with their foot, and a lot of them can't run. And my husband's fairly fast, so he sort of runs the whole boundary. And so it's great. And they have national competitions, and people come from all over Australia. So we were supposed to have one in Tassie next month, but that had to be, I think it's been fully cancelled now, but they have one in Echuca next month and people come from all over, and it's just the best.
Lauren, I'm going to have to find out the date so I can get down to that event in Echuca that you just mentioned. So they go away as well. They travel as a group as well.
Well, no, we meet as a group. So a lot of the guys will be staying in one of the caravan parks there, and I'm not sure which organisation up there runs it, but there's someone down here who runs it, and they just absolutely love it. And they all sort of get to know each other, and there's healthy competition, but lots of encouragement. So, it's really good.
Oh, that's so great.
Yes. Oh, look, thank you so much for calling, Lauren, from Mount Evelyn. And I'm going to look it up mid-March. I'm going to get down and see them. Yes. Hopefully they're playing at the beautiful Victoria Park in Echuca, which is a gorgeous.
They do. Yeah, they have. And all over the country, sort of within half an hour radius of Echuca.
So, brilliant. Well, thank you so much, and thank you for listening.
Okay. No worries. Bye.
This text, Erin, I hated sport at school. I wasn't really good at any of it. Most of my PE teachers weren't very encouraging of us fat, awkward girls. It killed my confidence, my ability to give any other sport a go for decades. That's from Anonymous. Well, I really hope that you did find a sport and that you found an environment where you can feel encouraged. Maybe you can't bend, maybe you can't run, you know, but you can still get out there and have a crack. But it does sound like you have.
Yeah, look, I've got another text here from Ruby in Melbourne. I graduated in 2017 and participated in PE and sport all through my high school education and still experienced skin fold tests, misogynistic male teachers. In year 12, I was one of two girls in my PE class. More needs to be done to encourage young girls to keep up PE and not defer. I think that's really important, Rich, because we're talking about experiences maybe from the deep, dark past of the 80s, but from Ruby there, 2017, it's not that long ago. And I think she's absolutely right. A lot of these issues are interrelated with each other. It's not necessarily just a physical one. There's a whole bunch of other layers to it as well.
Deep dark past of the 80s. With this humidity, I feel like my hair is, I'm bringing the 80s back well and truly at the moment. Paul Kennedy, very well known to ABC listeners, of course, ABC journalist and presenter, but also coaches two football teams and a cricket team in Melbourne's southeast. Paul, did you like PE as a kid at school? What was PE like for you?
Loved it, Rochelle. Time of my life when PE came around. I was one of those kids that just always loved sport, loved, you know, you couldn't stop me sort of moving. So, yeah, I never had a negative experience, except that I was probably too far one way and, you know, too much into sport. That's continued on to my, passing that on to my kids. I sometimes question whether I'm, you know, our lives are too much driven by sport and activity. But, no, it's been a big part of my life. It's a really interesting discussion that you're having, though, and I'm listening to it. Thinking that my views might be seen as in conflict with each other, because I actually think that the you know, kids need to be more active, and studies have been done on kids not being as active as they were back in the great old 80s, which I remember so well, or the bad old 80s. But having said that, you know, some of the language that you're getting through your experiences, and indeed through Swimming Australia's report, which made me angry. I mean, if you're doing skin folds these days, you're not a very good coach. And, you know, if you're talking about, if you're body shaming anyone, let alone adolescents and kids as they're finding their way, that's a disgraceful thing to do. We know way more, about, how dangerous that is. So, yeah, it's a really interesting discussion. I've really enjoyed, hearing you talk about it.
And PK, do you think that change is well and truly underway? I mean, we just texted from Ruby in 2017, her experience in school. Do you think there is a cultural shift happening?
I think there are too many bad coaches, and
it's pretty simple.
So I think the Swimming Australia. So coaching, and that's not to say that it's hopeless, because there are great coaches out there in all different sports and walks of life, but coach education's got to be a big thing. And bringing those coaches who don't quite get
but
it.
How accessible is that, PK? Because that's a really interesting point. You would find if you're talking like a super grassroots level, it's probably going to be some mum or dad or older brother or sister that goes, "Oh God, yes, all right, I'll do it," because no one else will. They're not having any formal training, and they're only probably leaning on how they've been coached or coaches that they've watched on the telly or whatever it may be. So it's tricky.
It is. It's a bit ad hoc. I think some sports are better than others at it. But if we look at that swimming example, I mean, Kieran Perkins came out when Matty Groves made those complaints and aired them publicly about the misogynist nature of swimming. Perkins said very, very shortly after, he doesn't believe that swimming's got a bad culture, and that there are no, I'm paraphrasing, but he said that he would defy anyone to say that the culture is bad at the moment heading into the Olympics. Then they bring in this report, and right now Swimming Australia is just apologised for anyone with a negative experience and detailing all those things. So I think in that one instance, you know, it's unhelpful that Swimming Australia is not releasing that report. You know, I've read the recommendation. One of the recommendations is to release the report, which they're not doing. So there are things that worry me there, but. But what I will say, and it gets to your point about, you know, this sort of bits and pieces solution to coaching, Swimming Australia is not in charge of every pool and every coach. And I know that there are state, I know personally, having spoken to people in Victoria, and I'm sure other states are well underway with their coach education. And it does have a lot to do with bringing in more female coaches. I mean, for too long, middle-aged blokes have been coaching, you know, particularly young girls. I mean, the other funny thing, Swimming Australia, the report said we should use AFLW as an example of of a sport that's leading the way. You're kidding me? There's no female coaches in the AFLW. Okay. So what a joke. And I find that very, very hard to understand. And if any sort of male administrator that's been in top level sport tells you that these things take time and we need to set a high bar for 10 years time. And come on, there are so many bad, underwhelming male coaches going around. You can't just say women aren't good enough to coach at that level. You need to put in practices to give them the skills and the support so they can be coaches, people of influence, and hurry up.
It's interesting, PK. I know I've talked about netball a little bit today, and that tends to be the cross that I carry around with me everywhere I go. Sorry, yes, Rish. I've already apologised in advance. and I know that you've covered a lot of netball in your time, PK. And I do think that netball does hold up an example because it's a sport built by women for women, where women are the default and they lead. And we know culturally at the very top level anyway, I mean, across the states, as you say, things differ from club to club and member organisations. But if you look at someone like the Diamonds, they have probably one of the strongest cultures, one of the least controversial, you know, the sort of running joke when the Australian netball, you know, when the netballers, super netballers were in the hub last year was that we didn't have any, you know, they weren't throwing kebabs at each other. They were too busy studying the university degrees. Do you agree that a sport like that is dominated by women is something that could be looked to by other sports?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's some really good, strong points there. Netball is a world-class sport, and it's a leader in sport in Australia. And you know, it's no surprise, I thought it was a great move by Cricket Victoria to make Sherelle McMahon head of women's cricket.
You mean poached, PK? You mean poached, don't you? From netball.
And a smart move. Well,
absolutely.
You know, and Sherelle, and they're going to build a statue about her, and they should, of her. And so she's gone to cricket, and I know that she will look at that sport and bring a wealth of experience from netball in regards to high performance and what it takes to be your best. So, you know, cricket's used its brain there. But no, I think netball is a leader. But I also think that, you know, personal experiences count for the, you know, if you and you know, you'd read Sharni Layton's book, which I encourage everyone to read Sharni Layton's book. And towards the end, her experience in netball was that, you know, the pressure around her position, she was relieved in the end to move into football and have that experience too. And so it's playing the sports off against each other is a bit tricky. But I think, yes, as a general rule, netball is a leader in a lot of ways. And you know, and it's got so many female coaches. We know that that's really obvious. But I would look at that and say, okay, so it's obvious that we've got great female coaches in netball. Why don't we have great, you know, so many more female coaches in swimming? Gymnastics? You know, gymnastics. And it's worth mentioning as well. I did a long story on this last year. Gymnastics for so many decades was caught up with this myth that the best gymnasts have to be 12 or 13 because that's the way the European countries and China were saying it had to be done. And so these athletes would go through their adolescence and their bodies would change as every child does. Mm. And they would go through horrendous experiences.
Yeah, I mean, that's coaches, the thing, 12 or 13, you know, don't have boobs and you're not going through puberty. I mean, I even anecdotally heard a similar story, PK, about a young dancer who was, you know, primed to be a prima ballerina and then at age sort of 15, 16, developed quite large breasts and then couldn't go on to dance. Hey, PK, stay with us because we want to bring Bo Vernon into this conversation. He's the senior head coach.
The great Bo Vernon.
Ah, yes, a Phillip Island Footy Club. Bo, a warm welcome to back to the Conversation Hour. When we're talking about this from a grassroots level, you know, as the coach of the Phillip Island Footy Club, did you have much experience coaching? Were you given much guidance or mentorship before you went about coaching?
Yeah, hello everyone, and been really enjoying the conversation. Not really, I suppose. Not much education around it. I've delved into books and the whatever the AFL's thrown out there, but when I was first appointed coach, I hadn't done much education at all, which, you know, I feel like I've adapted well and done things well, but I suppose, yeah, PK talking about a lot of maybe average coaches out there, and there probably needs to be some more education around it.
Well, I guess that sort of prompts the next question. Did you just sort of coach how you wish you would like to be coached, or did you take from your time on the other end to decide what kind of coach you wanted to be?
Yeah, I absolutely love playing football And I lost my passion for it for a couple of reasons, but one was one coach I had just made me feel not great. And I think, you know, one of the reasons why we do community sport and different things is to be a part of something, it's to enjoy it, it's to, you know, have connection and grow as people as well as the sport you might do. And and then I did a job over that summertime. I worked as a painter, which I hate as a painter, but I actually loved going to work because the people around me made me feel really good.
Yeah.
And, you know, you got one thing, footy, that you love that you didn't like, and then you had your work that you didn't like but you loved. And so as a coach, I really just – I just think it's about getting people to enjoy it, and if they enjoy it, they're going to put more time and effort in, they're going to have buy-in, and you're going to have, you know, essentially better results anyway, which isn't the most important thing, but yeah.
Bo, this is a kind of a personal question, so feel free not to answer it, but we've been talking a lot about, you know, body types, and people expect you to be a certain way in order to play or to coach or whatever it is. And now as a coach, as someone that is living in a wheelchair, if people have met you for the first time and then you say, oh, yeah, I'm also a footy coach, do people sort of question, you know, your playing experience, even though you played for a very long time, or just question your skills given that you do live in a wheelchair?
I haven't had it as such. I definitely have people ask, like, what are the challenges of coaching in a wheelchair? Mm. Where I never really get asked, what are the benefits of coaching?
Yeah, that's interesting.
From a wheelchair, everyone just assumes it's harder because I'm in a chair. But I think it's, you know, sports and different things are about relationships and how you make people feel. And I think by being in a chair and going through what me and my family have gone through on the journey of becoming a quadriplegic, I think it allows me to have better relationships and people sort of, you know, can respect me and what we've been through that little bit more and helps.
You've been a coach
things.
There for a long time, Bo, haven't you?
Yeah, I coached Lane Gather for 3 years and then Phillip Island for this will be my fifth year, and the last 2 years haven't been able to finish off the seasons. But, yeah, so 3 years at Leongatha, and then I've done 2 full seasons at Phillip Island, and, last 2 years have been pretty average with the COVID front.
And just finally, Bo, what would you like to see change? We've spoken a lot about whether it's the language that's used to make coaches better or for people to participate more, whether it be dropping skin fold tests, more female coaches. If you had the ability to change something, the power to change something, what would it be?
I think it's just more about these conversations and making people feel good. I suppose where does it come from coaches that maybe make people feel like that? And it's probably lack of education. Maybe it's appointing coaches that were good players but maybe not good with people. It's pressure and things like that. So just essentially think if coaches can be educated more on relationships, on enjoyment, on care, and trying to let their ego go on how well they go and just caring about the individual and growing as people more so than growing as in their sport. Like your number one focus is on people rather than player, or the human being rather than human doing. That's going to go a long way. So, yeah, it's just the education around those things.
Yeah, the human being, not the human doing.
I see why you're a great coach, man. You're getting all pumped up.
I don't know, Bo. If you're welcome to come up to my football netball club, just in a chuka up on the river, if you like. Thank you so much for your perspective and for joining us. That was Bo Vernon, senior head coach of the Phillip Island Football Club and coach extraordinaire by the sounds of it, Rish.
It's such a great club. I'm, as regular listeners would know, I've spent many summer holidays at Phillip Island my entire life, and you can get a mean counter meal at the local footy club there, and you can watch people run around and train while you're sitting there having a shardy and a parma and watch other people sweat it out. It's great. Paul Kennedy, PK, is still with you as well. We need more Bows, PK, don't we? But,
well, it's the perfect point because Bo Vern's a great coach. You know, he's won premierships down there and he would have won at least another one if they had finished seasons the last 2 years. But if you listen to him, he's got a high emotional intelligence. He's got life experience. He's got great empathy and he's a very, very smart tactician as well. But, you know, there's... The AFL, primarily because that's his sport, would do really well from promoting Bo and getting his message out there. And like he says, you know, hasn't won the Brownlow medals, but he's an outstanding coach. And I think if his circumstances were different, or if he wanted to throw his hat into the ring, he'd be a perfect head AFL coach tomorrow. But the other thing is with football, and we're always promoting football, I don't want people to think that I'm just sinking the slipper into swimming. I've had experiences too where it's problematic with teenagers who get into that high-performance system and then get told they're too fat or their body shape's no good or even if they've been injured. I think that the AFL's got a long way to go as well with those high-performance things. It's pretty good, if we were to have Bo Vernon in charge of every club, there wouldn't be a problem. The thing is to educate coaches to the point where they're better at what they do, and you know some people want to be better, but they just haven't got that support or information. So it's an ongoing thing.
And look, we've just had a text come in. It's probably a really good reflection after chatting to Bo. Then they bring up Ted Lasso, which those of you that haven't watched it on Apple TV, sorry for the brand name, Rish, really worth discussing on this matter because it really is, as this texter has just pointed out, it's a very funny, very uplifting show. But at the heart of it is a coach who cares really deeply about his players. I mean, some people probably call it, new age and support. That's the word our texter has used. But I think it's a really good example of a coach that can actually make a difference to people. I know myself, I resisted the urge to watch Ted Lasso. I'm one of those people, if you tell me to watch something, Rish,
no,
and
I haven't
PK,
watched it.
I will not watch it.
This is so long. I've given up. I am out of touch on anything and everything.
It is your homework, Rish, please, right, to go off and watch Ted this weekend. I'm imagining that you've seen it, PK.
Yeah, I really loved it too. It's got a bit of criticism because he's a middle-aged white guy coaching as well. But actually, the one of the great stories around that, on top of the coaching, is that there's a really, really caring and powerful woman in charge of the club as well. So, it's got different layers. Some people thought the second series went awry, but it was sort of examined his mental health. So I thought it was pretty good. I liked it. Big tick from me.
Paul Kennedy, of course, you know him, ABC journalist and presenter. He also coaches two footy teams and a cricket team in the southeast of Melbourne. Erin Delahunty, thanks so much for joining us today. I mean, you're going to be a regular contributor to The Conversation Hour. It's been so wonderful to have your insights as well. That's it for The Conversation Hour today. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget you can always subscribe to The Conversation Hour podcast. You can go to the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts, and that way you'll never miss an episode and you can share it with your friends and family. And if you have an idea or someone or something you want us to talk about, you can email us, conversationhour@abc.net.au. We always read those emails. Take care and speak to you soon.